Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. When we produced a program the other night in Washington, D.C. at Busboys and Poets with David Swanson, who had written the book War is a Lie, and we had a pretty rigorous discussion that evening with him for a live audience. We'll be playing for you in the next week, and it'll be on our website as well on Free Speech TV. We ran into some folks who were involved with this Movement for the People. A rally is being held tomorrow, and this with this action in D.C. over the next few days. Remember, almost a year ago today, actually it was a year ago tomorrow, that the Citizens United ruling was in the Supreme Court that allowed corporations to have the same speech as human beings, the same rights as our citizens of our country. So some people think that that has tilted the wheel in the favor of large corporations in terms of how government is managed and who gets a voice in government. And there are citizens across this country who've done shows on this before, in debate form and also in conversation with activists who want to change that. One of those people is Annabelle Park. She's a documentary filmmaker, political activist, community volunteer, and organizing this particular rally taking place in D.C. over the next few days. And we have her here to join us to talk about what's going on. And Annabelle Park, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I was watching you on YouTube today.
And
you laid out the reasons for this, for the actions you are taking in Washington this week. Talk a bit about Citizens United, United Citizens, and what you are doing exactly.
Right. Well, we're coming together on this very important anniversary to remind people that more than 80% of Americans actually object to this ruling by the Supreme Court, which made corporations persons. And there is a precedent for corporate personhood, but what this did was to say that corporations have the same rights as people. And so campaign donations are really considered speech. And this led to kind of unprecedented event during the midterms in which you had unlimited and often anonymous donations being made for campaign activities. And that shaped the dynamic in this midterm. And I think a lot of Americans actually don't realize the extent to which this particular ruling opened the doorway for that kind of corruption of our election process.
So tell me what's going on there. What exactly do you expect to accomplish with these 3 days, and and who is there, and what are you going to be doing?
What we're doing is we today actually had lobby day. We had volunteers go to a bunch of to meet with senators and their staff today, and we deliver the message that we're here. We're absolutely determined to do something about the level of corporate influence in our government. And it's not about some policy about funding campaigns. It's about the trust that we have in our government. With the role of money basically creating a conflict of interest in the government between choosing between the public interest and interests of these corporations that fund their campaigns, we can't sustain government in this fashion. So we want to engage Republicans and Democrats on how to fix this problem, because majority of Americans agree it is a problem. So we have a rally tomorrow at 11, We the People versus We the Corporations. We have people claiming they want to become corporations in order to have more rights. And we have We the People saying we are going to stand with the people. Corporations are not people, and money is not speech, making that clear. So there's going to be a bit of a showdown tomorrow. And then we're going to have 2 days of strategy meetings where we're bringing together grassroots organizers, netroots innovators. We have people who are experts in this policy area. And we're going to come together and figure out what strategic steps can we take to rein in corporate influence of our government and to empower citizens and communities. Because it's going to take both of those things, reining in with institutional legislative fixes, the corporate power we have governing our country, and we have to empower citizens so they understand that it is their duty and their responsibility to engage in the democratic process. Otherwise, we're leaving a huge vacuum in which people can manipulate the process for their agenda.
Now, one of the things, a few weeks ago we had a conversation with Congresswoman Donna Edwards, who's in the 4th District here in Maryland. She and others have introduced a constitutional amendment onto the floor of the Congress that simply reads, "The sovereign right of the people to govern being essentially central to a free democracy, Congress and the states may regulate the expenditures of funds for political speech by any corporation, limited liability company, or other corporate entity. Section 2 reads, "Nothing contained in this article shall be construed to abridge the freedom of the press." Now, part of what some people we had on this program in a debate with those who support the Citizens United ruling is a movement building around the country for a constitutional amendment, state by mm-hmm. state, to change the Constitution to limit speech to the right of individual citizens and the use of money that way. Are you part of that?
Yeah, you know, to be honest with you, I feel like we need to first engage in a real conversation nationally about the broader problem of the level of corporate influence in our on our government. And so I think the amendment is part of the tools that we have in our toolkit to try to rein in that corporate power. But I think there are other remedies that we can also consider. And frankly, I think we need to do multiple things at once.
What would those other remedies be?
Fair Elections Now Act, for instance, that focuses on public funding of elections. And then we have, you know, the idea of an amendment that's more focused on really clarifying what corporations are. So they're not just, they're not considered people. So there's the free speech equals money element, and there's corporations are people element. And I think we need to deal with both. We need to establish what it means to be an American citizen, what it means to be a corporation. They shouldn't be ambiguous. Seems like a very obvious, intuitive, you know, position that for some reason the Supreme Court doesn't seem to get. And I have to clarify that the Supreme Court decision was by a very narrow margin, was 5-4. And the dissenting opinion, especially the one written by Stevens, Justice Stevens, is you can feel the outrage. So this is not a given. This is not a legal interpretation that people agree with. This is very controversial. And so we need to me, it's about identity politics. Americans have to say, this is what it means to be an American person, an American citizen, right now, 2011. And we're not going to let you people in Congress and corporations and Wall Street decide what it means to be a person. Okay, I'm a person. You're not a person. You're a corporation. So we need to clarify that. And so I think there are many ways we can approach the general problem of corporations corrupting our government. But, you know, more than anything, I would like to really call upon American people to take the responsibility that we have to fix this. We can't wait for the government to fix itself. We have to make them fix this.
What will happen over the next few days? And how do people get involved with you if they want to be involved with you?
Yes. Well, Movement for the People is just a gathering of a different organizations saying, let's figure out how we can work together on this. So movementforthepeople.org is a place where you can go. There are toolkits. You can find out more about the organizations that are involved, including the Coffee Party, which is the one that I'm most involved with. And then we're going to also figure out a way to discuss this at the national level. It could be that we have national town halls, you know, for the rest of the year. And we also invite people to come to Washington lobby to start the relationship. We want to clarify that we are not against the government. We want the government working with us, because a lot of people inside the government are also aware that this is a problem. They don't want to spend 25% of their time raising money for their campaigns. They want things to change as well.
Right.
So let's work together to change it.
So, so specifically, people want to be in touch to find out where you're going to be. How do they do that?
MovementForThePeople.org is where you can find out where the rally is. It's in from the Capitol facing the Supreme Court in a section called Area 9. That's from 11 to noon. And then we're going to be at the Washington Plaza Hotel starting at 1:30. We're going to have some press conferences there and discussions about the impact of Citizens United. We're going to have a transpartisan dialogue about this in the evening. That would be really fascinating because, you know what, conservatives are also concerned about this.
Annabel Park, thank you so much. We will link to this on our website. Good luck over the next few days, and we'll follow what happens.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I hope everyone comes tomorrow.
Annabel Park, founder of the Coffee Party. Go to movementforthepeople.org to find out what's going on with people who are opposed to the Citizens United ruling. We're going to switch gears here and come back to Baltimore, which is where the show emanates from, and talk about development issues are always very tough in this town. They're always being fought around preserving buildings versus tearing buildings down. Do we preserve history or do we have a plaque? Do we need to preserve some of these old buildings? Do we need something new that says we're a 21st century city? Those are always part of the discussions we've had over the last 18 years on the air whenever these issues have risen up, which they do all the time. This particular issue about rebuilding the West Side, we've talked about a great deal over the last five, six, 7 years on this program from time to time. But this particular one has an additional wrinkle to it. This is about the development on the west side of the city of Baltimore, between Martin Luther King Boulevard and Charles Street, on the north, I guess it would be Reed Street, and on the south is, well, I'll get to me in a minute.
Lombard.
Yeah, right. So, but in that area, there is a place that is significant, and this is the day that it is significant. On this day, 56 years ago, Morgan State University students went to Howard and Lexington and to the shopping center just below here, Howard and Lexington, and sat in at the Reed's Drugstore, which was the local chain of drugstores in Baltimore City. And in 1955, they sat in to integrate those lunch counters, and the lunch counters, miraculously, people would say, in that day, were integrated because of the actions taken by those students. And we'll talk a bit about that. And it is a remarkable part of our history that took place at that moment. There was I'll read you a quote here that I found fascinating when we were doing research on this and actually found on the Heritage site. This is a dialogue that took place between a dean from Morgan State University, Dean George Grant, and a Reed's Drugstore official. I'll just read it to you so you get a sense of that moment in time that took place today. Today is the anniversary. And by the way, one of our guests today to talk about what we should do with this area is Dr. Helena Hicks, who participated in that sit-in 56 years ago today at Reed's Drugstore. She's a member of the Baltimore City Commission for Historical and Architectural Preservation as well. One of our scholarly elders of our community, who is here in the studio with us today, but she was there when this took place. This is what took place. The Reed's official says, "Please call your students off. They're staging a showdown here. We're losing business." The dean says, "We teach our students here. They must practice democracy and help others to understand it. I don't think you want us to tell them what they're doing is wrong." Reed's Drugstore says, "Yes, but we're losing business with them sitting at our counters." And the dean says, "Well, there are several things you can do." And Reed's Drugstore official says, "What's that?" The dean says, "Why, put a sign up in your window saying dogs, cats, and colored people are not allowed." The Reed's Drugstore official says, "Well, we couldn't do that." The dean said then, "Well, why not put an ad in the Afro saying that Reed wants colored people to shop there, but they can't eat there? And, you know, you have another alternative. You can say to all your customers, everyone can be served at our lunch counters." And the Reed's official says, "Well, we're all in sympathy with this thing. We'll see what can be done." And what happened was, a few days later, the lunch counters were integrated. And this was a model that became a model for the entire nation when what we call the first sit-ins happened in Greensboro, North Carolina, that started the civil rights movement of the 60s. Where there's four students were arrested from North Carolina A&T. What they did was follow in the footsteps of their older brothers and sisters at Morgan State College at that time, who sat in at that Reed's Drugstore. And Dr. Helena Hicks is one of our guests here in the studio. We welcome you to the studio, Dr. Hicks.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Bailey Pope, who's Vice President of Design and Construction at the Dawson Company, one of the developers working on the Superblock. Bailey, good to meet you, and welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
And Eli Poussin, did I have that right?
Eli.
You say Eli Poussin, right? Mm. Eli Poussin, field officer at Baltimore Heritage. Good to have you here, Eli.
Thank you so much.
So just for a moment, and then we'll talk about how this all fits in and what this future of this west side of town will look like. Take us back to that moment for yourself, that moment you were sitting in at the Reed's Drugstore on Howard and Lexington.
Well, I guess you have to remember
the Times, and that we rode the bus, city students, to go to Morgan, and we transferred at that corner to get the bus to come out. We had lots of grievances. The bus would not take us down the campus, so we got off at the bus at Northwood, and we had to walk all that long distance, regardless of the weather, regardless how many books we had to walk down to the campus and walk back up, likewise walk back up. If it was nighttime and the bus wasn't running, if you went off campus for some reason and you came back, you couldn't get a cab. So transportation was just impossible. All right, so you transfer at this corner. I think it was the number 3 bus we transferred to. You could go in Reed's and buy a pack of cigarettes, a pack of gum, but you're hungry. You can't sit down, and it might even be cold, snowing, raining, whatever. You can't sit down, drink a hot cup of coffee or cocoa or tea or anything. And so I guess you get to the point where you don't have to have somebody saying, aren't you tired? I think people collectively just are sick of it. The year before, you've had the Supreme Court decision to desegregate the schools.
Right.
So you feel like, you know, like, we need to keep this ball rolling. We have one of the most active NAACP chapters in the country. And so many of us were members of that. Certainly our parents were. So we had had other kinds of protests in the community before this relating to similar kinds of issues. So we went to Reed's. It was not, they say, some people have said it was NAACP pushing it. Some people said it was CORE. I don't even remember anything about CORE that early in Morgan's history. The NAACP did not come on campus and do anything. They had meetings and whatnot in the community, but they were not on campus. So it was really students saying, you know, we're gonna go in there and we're gonna sit down and they're gonna serve us.
did you all meet ahead of time and plan this out?
Sort of, but not. It was, you know, am I gonna get locked up if I say yes? Was because it was there was a law saying you couldn't do that in those days. No, I think that you really. Among yourselves, say, you know, I've had it. That's it. We're just going to go in here and sit down and see what happens. And, of course, they told us in a not nice way, you know, we had to get up and go out. And we sat there for a while. Eventually, we did go out. But I think they realized, because you must remember, more and more students are coming all the time to catch that bus.
Right.
And I think they were afraid of what was going to ultimately happen. And I think that's why they called Dean Grant. And you have to remember that Morgan was originally a religious-based school.
Right.
So that you had...
In the 50s even?
Well, no. I think it had changed over. It had changed over, although there were still students there who had come from that where churches were paying their tuition.
Right, right.
So that they you have a lot of professors there who are ministers on the weekend. You know, they have churches and whatnot. So you have a very good background for students doing things of this sort and not worrying about being kicked out of school, you know, which is always your greatest fear. Parents were not happy about it because they said that's not what we sent you to school for. You know,
so, but did you weren't arrested that day?
Oh no, they did. That's what I think people don't understand. We were not like the South. We were not arrested. Nobody called the police.
Did you leave voluntarily that day?
We left voluntarily. I mean, it was what, 2 or 3 blocks over from Pine Street Police Station.
Pine Street, where they put all the kids.
Yeah, right. And they could have easily have called and said, you know, come get them out of here, take them to Pine Street. They didn't do that. There was Hutchless next door and Bragger Gutmans, and because they had black employees, you know, cleaning people right. and whatnot. They did not enlist their help to get us out. There was no, there was not that kind of we're going to get you kind of atmosphere.
Did you intend to go back if they hadn't? Did you intend to repeat these?
Of course.
This was not going to end.
No.
I mean, I guess, suppose if you'd gone to the White Coffee Pot, you would have been arrested.
Now, that may be true.
Yeah, you would have been arrested.
Yeah, that was. I don't think Reed's. Well, we had never created a problem for them before. If we'd gone in there and bought something, we bought it and paid for it. We didn't steal from them. And,
right.
you know, we didn't make a lot of racket. So they didn't have a history of us being the world's worst disruptive people and worst students. Yeah.
Well, no, not that. Morgan, university students were not that disruptive, period, in the 50s.
No, they weren't.
Especially not on this campus.
No, they weren't. They didn't. They weren't. Yeah.
We said before, we had a show about this once before. It's a digression for 2 seconds. But there was probably no more polite class in the history of the United States of America than African-American middle-class families in the 20th, 19th century of this country. And so that was I think that was very real. But let's talk about the significance of that with what this controversy is now over that site that was Reed's Drugstore. And the question of does it come down or not come down in the redevelopment of the west side of this town. And let me just – we'll go around the room. But since Bailey Pope is in town today and was willing to come in, let me let Bailey start, and we'll go over to Ellie and then see what Dr. Hicks has to say and come back around. And welcome to the program, Bailey. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. The significance of the action of the students on this site is we're so excited to hear about it, and there's a kind of a poetic thing that now this site is being redeveloped by an African-American company. I mean, the Dawson Company is one of the largest African-American development companies.
Out of Atlanta?
Out of Atlanta.
Right.
And, you know, we're extremely aware of the fact that we would not have the right to be doing the work that we're doing if it wasn't for the courageous action of the students 56 years ago. So, you know, we recognize that and honor that, and you know we regret not having known about this earlier and being able to have incorporated it into our development program at an earlier time, but we are definitely dedicated to commemorating the event and looking at. I mean, typically these things don't happen in isolation, and we've heard some other stories from people about kind of the whole character of commerce. And, I mean, this was the commercial center of the city, and you know, all of the stores had policies. And, you know, this was striking right at the heart of it, being at the crossroads. But, you know, there's a story about kind of the progressive enfranchisement of the minority community in the commercial life of the city, and you know, so we're interested in looking at the whole story and you know, commemorating, you know, kind of the progress there with this event as kind of the pinnacle and the turning point that kind of eventually led to our being able to be here.
But the building that where this took place is under your plans will come down.
Well, there's two different things going on. One is honoring and recognizing and celebrating history. The other is continuing it's actually invigorating the economic development of the neighborhood. And there's you know, a number of documents that we've been responding to, the Urban Renewal Plan, the West Side Strategic Plan, as well as the Memorandum of Understanding agreement that looks at the Preservation Plan. And so we're working in the gray area in between, you know, a number of agendas. And a big, you know, big part of our effort is creating an economic environment there where small businesses, local businesses, have a shot at really surviving and you know, creating new businesses by creating an economic engine for the neighborhood. And this site is lends itself well to a development plan that focuses on overall economic growth.
So, and Ellie, then what, from your perspective, and then we'll go to Dr. Hicks, is the opposition here?
Well, I would agree that Baltimore Heritage, over our involvement for the past 10 years, has been thoroughly committed to this goal of neighborhood revitalization on the West Side. And preservation, historic preservation, has been at the center of what success we've had. Think of it, the Hippodrome, St. James Apartments, Stewart's Department Store, now home to Catholic Relief Services, all projects that benefited from millions of dollars of state historic tax credits and a preservation-centered approach to neighborhood revitalization on the West Side. And I think what we've learned about the Reed's Drugstore and the buildings on the Superblock speaks to their deep importance to the people of Baltimore, the city's history, the meaning that they hold, which makes them such assets to the revitalization of the West Side. Unfortunately, the proposal currently calls for the total or partial demolition of 14 out of 17 historic buildings on the West Side, including the Reed's Drugstore being completely demolished, in the adjoining buildings of McCrory's, which was a five and dime, H.G. Woolworth, another five and dime, a Schulte United, another five and dime, all down the 200 block of West Lexington Street, completely or partially demolished. And what we find once we start digging into the history, as was just observed, that this is a block and a set of buildings that tells the story of Baltimore in all its richness, including the long civil rights fight that went on here.
But before I turn to Dr. Hicks, I mean, and go back to Billy Pope, I have to take a break. I want to know, beyond the age of the buildings, I mean, why should some of those buildings be preserved? I mean, you can look at the Hippodrome and say, you got to preserve the Hippodrome because you can see the architectural significance of the building and what that building stood for and the history of it as a part of our entertainment district or the old Western High School, preserve the building. And you can see some of why is it so important to preserve a block that was a string of five and dime stores?
Sure. These might not be the grandest buildings in Baltimore, but to, I think, a lot of people, that makes them all the more important. It's places where students from Morgan went to go shop, where they went to protest when their rights weren't being honored as citizens of Baltimore. Furthermore, I think there's broad recognition that historic buildings are true assets to economic development, providing a pedestrian scale at a location which is one of the most transit-accessible locations throughout the city of Baltimore and should have a pedestrian scale vital historic streetscape to support that. In addition, this is a position that was endorsed by the recent findings of the Urban Land Institute when they brought a panel here back in December to consider these issues. I'd read from the Baltimore Sun article where they said no bulldozers are needed in this area from one of the panelists. This is not an area that needs urban renewal. It needs regeneration. And so what we're looking for here is use the assets that we have. These historic buildings should be incorporated into a revitalized West Side.
Dr. Hicks. Let's go to break, and then we'll come right back to Dr. Hicks and then back to Billy Pope, and then I'll raise some other issues. And have you join us at 410-319-8888. Those of you who know Baltimore City who are listening to this and live in this city or live around this city and know the West Side, your thoughts on its redevelopment, your thoughts on preserving the buildings, do they all need to be preserved or not, and their significance in the history of African-American, the history of Baltimore, but Baltimore's history in general. 410-319-8888 is the number to join us here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are talking about West Side Development and the question of preservation. And this being the anniversary, 56 years ago today, Morgan students sitting in at the Reed's Drugstore at the corner of Howard and Lexington. And it also became, that neighborhood became the center of my era's civil rights movement, sitting in at the White Coffee Pot and all the other places on that street. And I remember it was a period of time when, for the most part, for most places, Hustler Stewart's, black women would go in, could buy a hat, couldn't try it on. But it's a complex history. So the question is, does that building come down? Do we preserve Howard Street and that whole area on the west side? Can some of it be torn down, some of it saved? Or do you need to build a mostly new series of buildings to attract different businesses in? Billy Pope represents Dawson Company, an African-American-owned developing company out of Atlanta that is working on the Superblock. He's vice president there of design and construction, joins us in studio. Eli Poussin joins us. He is field officer at Baltimore Heritage, which is an organization that fights to keep old buildings preserved in this town and not knocked down. Dr. Helena Hicks was a participant in that sit-in and read structure tour 56 years ago and is also a member of the Baltimore City Commission for Historical and Architectural Preservation. The number is 410-319-88. Mike, before we come to your call, I just want to ask these two questions and then come back to where we left off. So we didn't get your take on this, Dr. Hicks.
Well, I think you have to look at preservation in a larger context. The city was not a city of fancy buildings and rich people. Everybody who arrived in the city from its earliest history were very, very ordinary people, immigrants who had been run out of their country. They all have a poor background. Nobody came here with a lot of money. So this central business district represents what Baltimore has always been. It has never been a city of built up from people who were large landowners and rich people. It is a common man's town. And that's what this strip represents. Lexington Market and that whole strip of businesses, that whole central business district, that is what this country was founded on, the working man. And the working man being able to have home and access to those amenities in life that make life comfortable. So it has a larger significance. Nationally, it has a significance because, yes, there were, someone called to my attention, another kind of sit-in that had taken place much earlier. Yes, there were other kinds of movements. Protests is protest. It can be by picket signs. It can be by work stoppages. It can take on many forms. This is just one form of a protest movement that said, this is a time you have to stop the racial stream that's been going on in this country and realize that we need equal rights. It's very significant nationally because it is the only student protest movement that we have a record of in this country. People have brought up other instances, and every time we've checked them, we've found out we still are. Greensboro was later than we were. Everybody else was later than we were. The other protests were either adults or a part of another issue. There were no other student protests, sit-ins, except ours.
I see most people don't realize that Baltimore was the first, which was really kind of an amazing piece. So the question is, let's ask you here for a moment, why things had to be torn down and what could be, is there an alternative or is there not an alternative?
All right. Thank you, Mark. I want to first kind of clarify some of the terms because the preservation community that's opposing our plan frequently points out sort of the number of buildings torn down and saved and stuff. I look at it more from the standpoint of the amount of the street wall. When people talk about the experience of the historic district and, you know, having a sense of what Baltimore felt like at a certain time, you know, the having a significant portion of the historic wall of the street preserved is I think more important than saying it's this number of buildings, because some of the buildings that we're looking at are extremely small and so small that trying to refurbish them and bring them into contemporary market use is very impractical. So the important point I think that needs to be made is that the development team has worked for a couple of years with the Maryland Historical Trust to strike a balance of preservation and progress where and what we have done is we are actually preserving on Lexington Street and on Howard Street over half of the original street wall. So we've got 51% of one street, 52% of the other street. On the whole block, we're 56% of
the... Is the Mayfair on that block?
No, the Mayfair is a couple blocks.
Five blocks, that's right. Yeah. I'm just trying to get my head wrapped around the... Okay, right.
Yeah. So I think that it's important to recognize we're not out there to raise the block. We've looked at it very carefully, and we're doing 100% preservation of three buildings, one that's got the only intact historic interior on the block, and that one is very clearly something where the building needs to be preserved. One that we're preserving, the Brager Gutman building, actually has utility. I mean, we looked at it and went through it and thought, as we did with all the buildings, we looked at them, went through them, said, you know, how can we use this? Is there a way that we can bring this into active economic life and take it out of being something that contributes to blight and decay in the neighborhood? Is there a purpose that we can put this building to that justifies investing in maintaining it? And the Brager Gutman building does have it's the shape of the building, the size of the building, is something that lends itself to reuse. Some of the other buildings, you know, you look at them and there's just, you know, not a way to bring them into a positive economic use.
There's a lot of people calling us. We want to get the show to the quiz, but I want to ask this question. Then I'll go to the phones then and come back with another question. Some people make the economic argument that you can't attract the kind of stores that people are talking about attracting this area with the size of those buildings. It can't be done. That some of the buildings just have to go if you're going to be able to do that. And then looking today as I was driving around there just to kind of get a feel for it again, and those buildings in that corner are pretty small and you have a hard time doing that. So is there an alternative to tearing down, or if you tore it down, is an alternative to just forgetting it? In other words, what I mean by that is, should there be a permanent thing on that site on the corner as a museum or some kind of that people can walk into that memorializes the civil rights movement, the actions that took place from 1955 to 1965 in Baltimore City to integrate this community legally? I mean, what can be done?
Well, Baltimore Heritage and many of our partners, particularly Preservation Maryland and the National Trust for Historic Preservation, have been arguing for over a decade now that preservation and neighborhood revitalization go hand in hand. They're mutually supportive. And what came out of that process 10 years ago was a set of city and state guidelines, the Urban Renewal Plan, the Strategic Plan, and something called the Memorandum of Agreement, which laid out some principles around which preservation and development could move forward together with an appropriate balance. Unfortunately, though, in the Maryland Historical Trust's review of this proposal, even initially, they found that it was among the least desirable from a standpoint of striking that balance of the proposals they received. And they continue to say that it has substantial, this is a quote, substantial adverse effects on historic resources, that it's been, the proposals have been repeatedly rejected, and that this most recent one is moving forward forward, we don't think means that this proposal has struck that appropriate balance. We think that there is room within this site, which is a large site, for a better balance between retaining important historic buildings and the new development that the West Side, of course, could benefit from, which we are supportive of.
But it still doesn't get to the point where I was just saying. I mean, what gets torn down, what doesn't? And why, is there another way to do this by saying that you have to put on this site something that memorializes what happened on that site? And I don't just mean a little monument. I'm talking about something significant.
Well, and I don't think that we need to be told that we have to do that. We now that the Baltimore Heritage has finally decided to share the research that they've done and let everybody know about the events there, we embrace it. I mean, this is something that from the Dawson Company standpoint, this is very important history and it needs to be commemorated. And we're very eager to work with the community here on determining, you know, what's the most appropriate commemoration of that event and of the arc of events in the neighborhood.
Well, I think that I've been around the country and even abroad, and it's hard for me to believe, especially when you go to other countries, that there's no way to keep that building and find a good use for it. Because when you go other places, you see small buildings and you see uses that they make of ancient buildings, far older than Reed's Drugstore. And people go. It does attract tourists. And they turn out to be all kinds of uses that they make of them. I do believe that there is an appropriate use that can be made of that building that would be an income-producing site. I have yet to hear a good reason why it needs to come down, other than it doesn't fit into somebody's dream of what the whole area looks like. It's really Baltimore's history. And I really think that regardless of what other people, what organizations they represent, if it is a part of Baltimore and it is significant to the largest population in Baltimore, which is African American, and it is significant to national history for the progress that has been made for African Americans, then that really is more, it outweighs a lot of the other issues. I can't believe that there can't be a use that is income-producing made of that building.
Well, let me just, in all fairness of time, I'll let you come back in 1 second to respond. I know you, unless you have a short response, there's so many people calling in, I want to let some people get a chance to have their voice on the air. 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Is that me? Okay. Yeah, so I think she just said it elegantly. I mean, there's a difference between value, as in per square foot, commercial-driven uses that are, standard, and our values. And I think it is a completely legitimate question to ask in a 65% African-American city with its rich history why there are not more. I mean, clearly we have the Reginald Lewis Museum, but that's sort of curated, right? But when you look at, the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum, you look at some of the other places around the country that really give honor and monument in a 65% black city, I think it's a legitimate question to ask. And I think part of the answer and question that we need to continue to ask ourselves is, how is equity framed in our thinking in terms of what gets torn down and what we value as a society and as a city versus just value in terms of market values?
It's a cogent point. It's the same one. It's similar to what Dr. Hicks was just making. Before we go to our next two callers, I think it's only fair to let Billy Pope respond to both things he's just heard.
The economic argument has to do with looking at creating jobs and creating economic opportunity in a community that's distressed. Many people don't remember, but the Dawson Company has been active in this neighborhood for over a decade. We were the development manager for CenterPoint, partnering with Bank of America Community Development Corporation. And that one, I think everyone in the preservation community would agree, is a real success for preservation. And it's a reasonable success as a market project. The apartments are remaining high occupancy, and a good deal of the retail has been leased. But I think it's important to look at some of the stuff that isn't leased, and some of the stuff that has not exceeded the lowest common denominator of retail, and try and understand why that happened. Why did this project not achieve the economic development goals that were the larger context for the city's effort in it? And that's, we've gone through that and looked at it. And the important things that need to happen are that we need to create a commercial environment in the neighborhood where there's a lot of foot traffic. You need to have a destination quality retail center that's going to change people's perception of the West Side as a decrepit neighborhood and bring back the historic, everybody remembers when it was a shopping destination, but it's not now. and we want to create that again. And what we're proposing is a facility on a very similar scale to the historic department stores that characterize the neighborhoods there.
Let me get things called and then come back with a question for all of you so we can close the show in peace. You're on the air.
How you doing, Mark? This question really goes to the representative from Dawson. Now, my whole take on this thing is that you come to Baltimore, just like me going to Atlanta, and just say what MLK, Martin Luther King, has his church, and I just wanted to come down and I just wanted to build a Target on next to that. Now, do you think a predominantly black city like Atlanta is going to allow me to come there and build a Target right next to it, which is supposed to be a national black historic museum? No, they're not. I mean, believe it or not, I know you probably don't think that we have a lot of black civic pride of people. Let me tell you what those old buildings down there represent to me. Represents the racism that was involved in this town way before we became integrated and did the things that we really need to do. There need to be some change, but to just come in here and just cosmetically tear the whole down because there's no commercial development in this town is not true. Because I'm gonna tell you the truth. Now, out of all the jobs that are gonna be down there, first of all, when you tear all this stuff down to build, how many black African Americans going to have these jobs with the construction, with the marketing, with the engineering? Those are the questions that before you decide to tear one brick down, it need to be discussed. Thank you, Mark.
All right. A response here from Billy, then go to the other side. Billy?
You bring up a great, great question piece, and I do want to respond to that. Inclusion is a huge part of our development model. When we did CenterPoint, we met the goals. Basically the city's goals are 27% of the construction work should be dedicated to minority-owned businesses, an additional 10% to women-owned businesses. We met that goal on CenterPoint. It's been a Dawson Company policy since we've benefited in the past from similar kinds of things to be very inclusive in all of our contracting. In right now we're working on a project in Cincinnati where it's gone beyond just the contracting. It's not just supporting minority-owned businesses, but there's actually a workforce development program where we're looking at the number of jobs, who's got them, what race they are, what neighborhoods they're coming from, and making sure that the economic benefit of the construction activities are really filtering down to the community that's most impacted by the project.
We only have like 5 minutes left here in the court for this discussion, so I just want to kind of hone down into the big question here on this particular development is, from your perspective very quickly, what can be done if you disagree with what they're doing? How do you say to the people developing the city, what should be done with that site and how you preserve it so it's viable. I mean, I'm looking at it. I see the reason. It's still there, but I mean, doesn't look anywhere near like what it looked like when either one of us were younger and walked past there. So, I mean, very quickly, I mean, what do you do to preserve? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, I think that it's great that we're getting a chance to share this story more broadly with folks that already know the history of Reed's Drugstore and people who this is maybe the first time they've heard about it. We're doing an event in partnership with the Reginald F. Lewis Museum on February 9th from 7 to 8:30 in the evening on preserving Baltimore's civil rights heritage. And this will be a public forum and panel discussion touching on both Reed's Drugstore as well as the proposed National Civil Rights Heritage Trail and putting this in that broader context of saying these are stories that really matter to people and the buildings tell those stories better than anything else could. And those stories and the historic character of the built environment, it can be a great driver for neighborhood revitalization. And we've seen that on the Avenue up in Hampton. We've seen that down in Federal Hill, Belvedere Square. So together, recognizing that these buildings matter and that we shouldn't throw away our past and what's important to downtown Baltimore and in favor of a proposal that might not be the only way that we can do things, that let's take our time and see if we can integrate these buildings into a proposal that will contribute to neighborhood revitalization on the west side.
Very quickly, Dr. Hicks, we only have a few minutes
left.
Well,
I certainly agree with him, and I don't want you to forget that this is part of Morgan's heritage, too. And this is a large institution. It's predominantly African-American. It has students from all over the world. Image is important. It belongs to our heritage at Morgan as well. You cannot come to the table with people who are writing checks or who are in positions of power and say, we make the decision. The decision has got to be made by all the people that the decision affects. So we have to have a gathering of the minds beyond whatever is done at the business table.
I only interrupt this, but we're out of time unless you have like a 10-second thought.
Just from the standpoint of let's take our time and stuff, you know, this effort has been underway. The original urban renewal plan, I think, was in the mid-'80s. So there's been an awful lot of time and consideration given to trying to revitalize this neighborhood. And, you know, at what point do we say, okay, we've thought about it enough. It's time to go and bring some progress into the west side.
Billy Hope from the Dawson Company, thanks so much for willing to come in the studio. And Eli Pusin, thank you for being in here from Baltimore Heritage.
Thank you.
And Dr. Helena Hicks, it is an honor to meet you, one of the original people who sat in at Reed's Drugstore 56 years ago today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sitting in at Reed's Drugstore, having the courage to do that in 1956. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back and meet Carl Stokes. Many of you know, city councilman. Rumor has it he wants to be mayor. We're going to find out why when he comes into the studio and talk about that. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or just click on the Mark Steiner Show and click on its banner. We'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by
the Morgan MBA program, now offering an 8-week praxis prep course in preparation for admission to